This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Scientists at UNC Charlotte, along with six other research organizations, were approached by the government to study alternative energy sources. The government wanted to know which technologies held the greatest promise for helping to reverse global warming or climate change while meeting our ever-growing demand for energy. They hoped the researchers could tell them which technologies were the best bets for investment. UNC Charlotte used their nearly $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to study how various factors impact the performance of solar technologies. But as they became immersed in their research, they came to a troubling conclusion, at least troubling to me. The conclusion, there is no solution. Here to talk about their research and their conclusion is Dr. Deborah Strumsky, Associate Professor in the Department of Geography and Earth Sciences at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for bringing such a uplifting topic to our attention.
Good morning.
Also with us by phone from Utah is Dr. Joseph Tainter, Professor of Sustainability in the Department of Environment and Society at Utah State University. Thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
I'm told that you are kind of like a mentor to Dr. Strumsky here.
Well, I'd say a colleague. We've worked on one project together and hope to work on some more projects together.
I'd like to start at the beginning here. What was UNC Charlotte asked to do by the government? I think I explained it, but maybe I didn't, so just explain it to me.
Well, the SunShot program has two points of interest that they're trying to pursue. One is looking at the dynamics of energy innovation, specifically in photovoltaic systems, and the other was adoption of photovoltaic technology. And the portion that my team is working on is on the dynamics of innovation. So that's what
meaning,
we're pursuing.
Meaning how various new innovations come together and multiply on each other, essentially?
It's really to improve forecasting of technological advancement in photovoltaics and to understand the micro-mechanisms. So a lot of the times what we're doing when we're looking at how technologies evolve, we look at something called a very common one that everybody would understand would be Moore's Law. This is that idea that the number of circuits on a chip double every year or so. Well, a more general statement of that is what we call Wright's Law, and that's performance curve analysis, that with every subsequent unit you produce, you produce it more efficiently, and the cost declines. But we don't always understand exactly the mechanisms that are bringing down the costs. So we understand the slope of the line. We understand cost reduction. We don't always understand the micro drivers of why the costs are coming down.
We're going to come back to that because that plays an important role in your conclusion, I believe.
Yes.
what were some of the other research organizations involved in this project? Because this wasn't just UNC Charlotte. The government's pushing out across the country for this.
Yes, they've recruited from there were several grants given out. There was a team out of UTexas at Austin. There is a group out of MIT. Several of the national labs are involved. And even my own team, we're partnered with Oxford University and with Arizona State University as well.
And why is the government putting money into this? Why? Because there's money to be made if you come up with a solution, and maybe there is no solution, as we've already said, but if you didn't know that going into this. So if you were to come up with a solution, there'd be money to make. So why aren't private companies putting money into this as opposed to the government putting money into this?
There are a lot of companies working on this, but right now, particularly with the price of natural gas, cost competitiveness in photovoltaics is – we're not quite there yet. We're working on it. The costs have really come down dramatically, but it's still not quite enough that a private firm without revenue from other sources can be cost competitive
in
the market.
Let's talk about that because the Department of Energy wants to make solar energy more competitive. And I understand that natural gas right now is inexpensive. And even the price of a gasoline has come down because we found new ways to extract oil that was previously unavailable to us out of the earth through fracking and other technologies. But why isn't solar cost competitive now? I know that it takes infrastructure to build all these arrays, but once it's up and running, there are no costs.
Oh, there are costs.
Are there? Okay.
There are costs. Actually, it's It doesn't require a lot of manpower, but you still get a cost per megawatt hour. That's still, the upfront cost is high. And even though you think, well, I'm just going to put something on the roof of my house, when you're talking about something like a concentrated solar collector farm, very, very small amounts of dust will completely eliminate the efficiencies on one of those solar panels. So actually, they have to go out and clean those on a daily basis, making sure that you've got the right location, maximum efficiency. And from a power grid perspective, which is where really a lot of the problems come in, if there is a decline in the sunlight, you have a couple of clouds go over, you know, above the solar array, the efficiency of that system goes down. The amount of output that that system can put out goes down. So what the problem you have is you get big fluctuations from solar and wind, instability in the grid, so you have to have a backup plant running at the same time. Right. That's part of the problem.
And we don't have the battery technology required to store a lot of the energy that we could store if we had the technology.
Yeah, and actually I was just at a meeting yesterday where they're looking at, Germany has some really interesting technologies. They're looking for large-scale storage, but that is actually the holy grail. A lot of our energy problems are solved with storage.
Now, Dr. Tainter, you are a social scientist, not a technical expert, but you are also the author of several books, one of which is called The Collapse of Complex Societies, The Way the Wind Blows, Climate History and Human Action, as well as your most recent book, Drilling Down, The Gulf Oil Debacle and Our Energy Dilemma. So you know a lot about energy and about societies and how society uses energy and how all this comes together. Has our need for energy ever been greater in the history of human beings?
Oh, no. And people generally don't think about energy except as the cost affects them. Otherwise, energy is something that goes into your gas tank or comes into your home. But we don't understand how much more energy we use today than we used to use in the past.
How much more energy do we use today than we used to use?
Well, it's something on the order of 100 times more than our ancestors used.
And when you say ancestors, how far back are you going?
Before the Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
Basic human metabolism uses about 100 watts, if you think of a 100-watt bulb on a continuing basis. And our ancestors didn't use much more than that. Today, the average American uses about 10,000 watts on a continuing basis. So we have this dramatic need to be continually finding and using energy, and our whole way of life depends on it.
It also seems to me that we take, as you said, energy for granted, because I remember growing up, and my father would get upset if I left the light on in my bedroom if I wasn't in the room. "Do you think this is a bank?" he would say. So today, not only do we have light bulbs all over the house, we have computers running and television sets and appliances that never really go off.
Right.
So has it become cheaper, or have we just gotten accustomed to paying constantly for energy use?
Well, we are in effect subsidized by energy. The energy that we use comes primarily from fossil fuels, and that is the accumulation of past solar energy that produced great forests in the past that died and decayed and formed seams of coal or pools of petroleum, so that in effect we have this bank account in the ground and we draw it out to produce the energy that we need. So we don't actually earn our energy. We're subsidized by the energy, by past solar energy that accumulated millions of years ago. And that's one of the reasons why we don't think about energy, or we tend to think that it's essentially free. Because for us, it is free. We haven't actually earned it.
Hmm. But we've got to start thinking about it, it would seem to me, because of climate change, which we will talk about, and also because a lot of people who don't use the kind of energy that we use in America are coming online and beginning to demand this. Modern society can't function without energy, can it?
No.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I mean, what would happen to us if we had to use less? It seems to me we use so much more today than we used even 15 or 20 years ago.
Go ahead, Debbie.
No, actually, I was just going to say, yeah, we're part of the conundrum that we're in here is as we have innovated and driven down costs of energy, and this whole DOE initiative is the goal is to drive down solar costs by 75%. So we've been very successful through fracking, all these new technologies, photovoltaics, wind power, making it more sustainable in one part, but also driving down costs. As we've done that, the problem is something called Jevons paradox. The cheaper you make it, the more we use. And this is where things get very complicated, because now it becomes feasible to have all kinds of appliances that we plug in. We use a lot more power. There was a brief dip. If you look at population growth rates, population's increasing at the same time that each person is consuming more energy. There was a brief slowdown in that during the recession. We slowed down on our energy use,
right.
But that has picked right back up, and we're continuing to use more energy per capita.
But technology will solve all these problems. That is the great assumption on the part of a lot of people, because we've seen what technology can do in other arenas. And Dr. Strumsky, you've been looking into a variety of research questions regarding innovation in sustainable technology. That's the whole thrust of your piece of this pie. And you say it is often assumed that if enough resources are invested in innovation, then significant, even catastrophic environmental disasters can be averted and challenges overcome with little change in income or lifestyles. How did we, as a society, reach that conclusion?
Well, I think societies and a lot of political pundits are in a state of denial. Part of what pulled me into the specific research I'm doing now was back-of-the-envelope calculations. I heard speech after speech after speech of people saying, we can invent our way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about climate change. We can invent our way out. Mm-hmm. And when you did some back-of-the-envelope calculations at innovation growth rates and some climate change goals, what you found out was within about 23 years, the investment necessary would equal the entire budget, the GDP of the United States, and it would consume all of our resources.
Now, do the pundits making these claims know that?
I think everybody, when you speak to people in the Department of Energy, I think they do understand that these are very, very difficult to achieve, and that without significant lifestyle changes, mm-hmm. We cannot meet climate goals that easily.
And what do you mean by significant lifestyle changes?
We want to be able to drive our car whenever we want. We want to be able to wash our clothes whenever we want. We want to be able to use as many lights and large screen TVs whenever we want. We have power, unlimited amounts of electricity and fuel whenever we want it. That's actually not the norm for a lot of people on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people might get energy for a couple hours a day. That's not the situation. We want it on demand and in
right.
unlimited amounts.
And are you saying that in order to be able to continue, I'm not even sure how to put this question, that that's not going to be the reality in 23 or 25 or 30 years?
We have a choice to make. And one is, how much do we want to spend to – because a lot of our engineering – we can engineer our way out of these problems. The fact of the matter is, can we solve – do engineers and technologists know how to build systems to be sustainable? Yes, of course, but at what cost? How much of an economic hit are we willing to take to do that? So the engineering problem is just that, an engineering problem that can be solved. The problem is the effect on the economy and our quality of life. How much are we willing to give up to do that? And that's the
trade-off. I know the answer to that question.
Not a lot. I mean, yeah, exactly. We do see when the price gets expensive enough. A couple of years ago, we had an issue here in Charlotte where there was a pipeline on gas. Gas hit over $5.50 a gallon. People drove very differently, and
yeah.
they really, you know, organized shopping and other tasks to make sure they minimize their fuel use. But that kicked in around $5 a gallon.
Right. And also the absence of premium gasoline there for a while. You couldn't buy it.
Exactly.
Wasn't available. Dr. Deborah Strumsky is Associate Professor of Geography and Earth Sciences at UNC Charlotte. She's in our studio. Dr. Joseph Tainter, Professor of Environment and Society at Utah State University in Logan, Utah, is with us by phone. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Winston-Salem, where visitors can savor southern fresh cuisine, rich regional art, and living history within an hour's drive of Yadkin Valley wine country. Details at yoursouthernwakeupcall.com. And Floors for Less, a professional flooring services company providing carpet, laminate, hardwoods, and more, serving the Charlotte, Gastonia, and Concord region, floorzforless.com. What would you do if you invited somebody to dinner and they stayed for a month? This is actually a true story. It dealt with Betty Davis coming to somebody's house during a hotel worker strike in New York. It's become a play called Me and Jezebel, and we'll meet two of the people involved in that production, including the man who plays Betty Davis tomorrow at 9. And we'll also find out about street performers. There's a new documentary about buskers who are making their presence known on our streets. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new research suggests that college for all approach needs revision. Who benefits from college and why?
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a study of solar energy commissioned by the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, of UNC Charlotte, among other research organizations, to find out where to best put investment capital to come across with the best chance for success in making solar energy more available and more practical and more efficient and more affordable, essentially, is what that is. Dr. Deborah Strumsky is with us, Associate Professor of Geography and Earth Sciences, and Dr. Joseph Tainter from the University, from Utah State University, a Professor of Environment and Society. Part of the problem here is technology. We think technology is going to solve all of our problems. And as technology comes online, our world becomes not simpler, but increasingly complex. And Dr. Tainter, I know that you know that you can speak to the fact that with increasing complexity comes increasing cost, and I'm told this is a very scary thing, eventual collapse. Talk about that for a second.
Well, that's correct, and complexity interacts with energy. They work synergistically together. The more energy you have, the more complex your society can be. But at the same time, we also tend to solve problems by growing more complex, which requires more energy. If you think of, for example, hybrid cars, that's a more complex mechanism than a car with only one engine. So we tend to grow more complex to solve problems. In the history of oil production, there was a time once when we could find oil essentially by sticking straws in the ground. There's an interesting case in Los Angeles in the 1890s in the Los Angeles area where oil wells were actually drilled using sharpened eucalyptus trees. Now, if you think from that to how we get oil today, using very expensive, complex mechanisms like these rigs that you see in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon, which was a very expensive rig, cost about $1 billion to build and about $500,000 a day to run. These things cost enormous amounts of money. They're highly complex machines, and as we saw with Deepwater Horizon, they're quite risky to operate. So why are we using these complex, risky means of producing oil? Well, the answer is because we've used up the easy oil. We've used up the oil that was shallow in very large pools, and so now we have to look for oil in places that I call deep, dark, cold, remote, and dangerous. We're searching for oil, for example, off the coast of Greenland in the same environment that sank the Titanic. We're looking for oil a mile underwater in the Gulf of Mexico, and we're developing these elaborate technologies to get oil out of shale. What happens is that your net return goes down. It takes energy to get energy, and as you have to look for oil and produce it from these places that are harder and harder to get to, your net energy goes down. We have a term that we use. It's called energy return on investment. And what it means is energy return on energy invested, not monetary investment, but energy investment. Back in 1940, the United States was able to produce oil at a net energy of 100 to 1, which means that for every barrel of oil we'd invest in finding and producing oil, we'd get 100 barrels back. By 1970, that was down to about 30 to 1, mm-hmm. and today it's down to about 15 to 1. The early figures for oil shale suggest a net energy of perhaps about 13 to 1, although that's only in the best places. In other places, it goes down to as low as 6 to 7 to 1.
And oil shale requires fracking to extract the oil from the shale.
Oil shale requires fracking. There are a couple of different ways of getting it out, but okay. Yeah, basically the one that the public is familiar with is fracking. And so we use more and more complex technology to get oil in more and more remote places and from smaller and smaller pools. And this is increasing complexity, producing what economists would call diminishing returns, meaning that you put more in and get less and less back. And this is a factor in my study of historical societies. This is a factor that ultimately caused past societies to collapse, where they would be confronted with problems. They would address the problems by investing more and more, becoming more and more complex, but at a cost of diminishing returns.
Give me an example of what you're talking about, because obviously they weren't dealing with oil or energy. They were dealing with other systems, correct?
They were dealing with other issues. The example I use most often is the Roman Empire, which I studied extensively. Mm-hmm. And in the 3rd century AD, the Roman Empire nearly came to an end. It actually broke up at one time into three parts. And it was rescued in the late 3rd and early 4th centuries by a series of reforming emperors. And what they did was they increased the size and complexity of the government. They increased the size and complexity of the army, as much as doubling the army in size. And this worked. They were able to sustain the empire for another 200 years by this strategy. But it was very costly. Ultimately, it led to a quadrupling of taxes on the peasants, who were the main economic basis of the empire, so that costs went up, but really there were no net wealth was accrued. They were simply able to maintain the status quo.
Isn't that happening here right now?
That's exactly what's happening right now, is higher and higher costs to maintain the status quo. This is why the price of energy has gone up so much in recent years, is because of declining net energy, energy return on investment. We use the acronym EROI for that. Because of declining EROI, costs go up just to maintain the status quo.
So you
run faster and faster just to stay in the same place.
So we've built a house of cards.
We have built a house that depends on continuing inputs of very profitable energy. As energy becomes less profitable, it does more and more become a house of cards.
So since it takes energy to produce energy, it would seem to me it takes a lot of energy to pull coal out of the ground and transport it to a electric production facility. It takes a lot of money to pull oil out of the ground, wherever it happens to be, and transport it and refine it and then transport it again to gasoline stations around the country. Why then isn't it cheaper to invest money now in oil, in solar, in wind, in thermal, in whatever, in wave energy, even if the technology isn't quite ready yet? Why isn't it just as wise to invest in that as it is in putting money into oil and gas and coal?
Part of it has to do with Joe, I was just going to go back to the idea of the ROI, the energy return on investment, is that even though it costs a lot of money to get coal out of the ground, get it to the plants, burn it, and all of that. The fact of the matter is they're so energy dense. The return on energy investment is so high on fossil fuels that it's hard for renewables to compete. So, like you said, you have levels anywhere between.
Even when you add in things like the monstrously expensive cleanup in the Gulf that BP had to endure because of the spill, even when you add in things like that?
The power of fossil fuels is really quite amazing. We haven't experienced anything like that in human history, what the Industrial Revolution released with fossil fuels. And the problem with the renewables is they just don't have the same energy return on investment. And that's why they're having a hard time competing in the marketplace.
Mm. Well, you and one of your colleagues at Arizona State University have been working on the study of the evolution of technologies over long periods of time and constructed a classification of three types of technologies: originations or breakthrough technologies, something that was never here before and suddenly, because of it, new worlds open up, recombinations of different technologies to create something new, and refinements of current technologies that improve the quality of those technologies. Is that what brought the Department of Energy to your doorstep, the fact that you'd already looked into this?
Partially. I hope so anyway. What we were looking at is, can we predict technological pathways? We're never going to be able to predict a specific invention. But the idea is, can we predict pathways that innovation will take? So actually, when we talk about this in economics, Innovation is considered a random or exogenous event, something that can't be predicted. It serendipitously happens out there in the world. But when you actually look at the models and you take long historical records and you take the first instance of an innovation, so if you look at the very first instance of an automobile, and then you look at how technologies recombined, an economics argument under classical economic theory would suggest that it's completely random, that any invention at any time would just occur. But think about it. The very first cars could only go back and forth. They were they had very limited maneuverability. So what's the first thing you do when you have a car that can only go back and forth in a straight line? You want to turn it. So obviously it took a very direct channel to steering. Once you could steer, you wanted to take it on roads, down pathways. And then, of course, you want speed. So the innovation shifted from steering to speed. Once you can go fast, you want to stop. So you could actually have looked at and predicted the pathways that the technology would evolve in. And this is partially what the DOE is interested in, is can we predict the rate of invention by understanding the inputs into all these renewable systems, specifically photovoltaics? Their focus really is on photovoltaics, but we're doing this for all energy systems, all the biofuels and all these others, to see how the technologies evolve.
You also have looked at the socioeconomic, technological, political, institutional, organizational, and cultural things that come in and interact to foster innovation and to sustain long-term growth. So before I ask another question about today's topic, are we to assume that those factors do in fact interact and produce ever-expanding, ever-quickening technological improvements?
Yes, they do. Certainly as one, because technologies do interact, an advancement in one area certainly allows other areas to look at a technology and go, how can we borrow that? How can we improve our product or the efficiency or drive down the cost of our product by incorporating this other technology from this other area? So there's a lot of that.
So this seems very optimistic to me on the one hand. On the other hand, you come in here with this doom and gloom.
Well, actually, can we innovate? Yes, we're people are brilliant and then in the innovations they bring about. The problem is we love it so much that we keep wanting more and more and more of it. And that means in order to sustain the growth economically, we have to invent faster and faster. And the question is, can we keep up with this treadmill?
And Dr. Tainter, your research has revealed that energy is being consumed so quickly and in such large quantities all over the world that it is almost too fast to slow down. But given – I'm going to come back to Moore's Law and Wright's Law, which you referred to a few minutes ago, Dr. Shrumsky. Won't our ability to deal with this change or this use of oil or energy – actually change exponentially over time? If the number of transistors on a computer chip was accurately predicted by Mr. Moore of Intel years ago, and it's proven to be absolutely right, although he had no reason to know that when he made that prediction, and it's based on Wright's Law, why wouldn't that apply to technology in the energy field and then get us out of this mess?
Let me go back to complexity a little bit to answer that, and I'm going to refer to some research that Dr. Strumsky and Dr. Lobo and I did, published a couple of years ago on the productivity of innovation. Innovation is like any human activity. It's a problem-solving exercise, and it grows more complex over time. If you think back to the 19th century, we had the famous 19th century naturalists, Charles Darwin and Gregor Mendel, Marie Curie. But today, research is largely done in big interdisciplinary teams, such as the team that that Dr. Strumsky worked with on her work on solar energy, on photovoltaics. So what happens is that the research enterprise itself grows larger and more complex and costly. And in looking at the patent statistics, what we found is that the productivity is actually declining. We looked at about a generation of data from 1974 through 2005, and what we found is that the productivity of innovation over that period actually declined by 22%. This is a very worrisome trend, and the reason seems to be because of increasing complexity and increasing costs of doing research. So I'm not confident that Moore's Law can continue forever, because it's going to cost us more and more to keep doubling the number of transistors on a chip, or the density of transistors on a chip. And the time is going to come when it simply won't be possible to do it, or it will be too expensive to do it. And you can see that really in how computer makers are adapting today. It used to be that computers came with a single processor. Then they started coming with dual-core chips, and then they started coming with quad-core chips. And this is all a way of keeping up increases in speed, because that's now the easiest path to take is simply to put multiple processors on a chip rather than make single processors faster and faster. So I think one of the challenges that we face in the future is actually the declining productivity of innovation, and if the trend continues for another generation, we're not going to be able to rely on innovation to solve the resource problems that we face.
Hmm. Is that why your license plate reads Dr. Doom?
I don't know where you heard that, but I did not make that up. My wife had that made up.
But I don't understand why innovation has to slow down or stop. Human society has been innovating since the caveman. Maybe not as quickly as what you're saying is that we can't innovate quickly enough to solve the problem that we're facing.
The problem is that to continue innovation at the rate we have become accustomed to would take a larger and larger share of our gross national product. You know, if you think of our economy as a pie with every sector getting a share, if research and development have to take a larger and larger cut of the pie, that means there's less for everything else.
Well, Dr. Strumsky mentioned that in 23 years, to achieve the energy efficiency that's mandated in the Kyoto climate protocols, which we did not sign on to,
right.
But if we wanted to, it would consume the entire GDP of the United States. But this is not just a United States problem. This is a worldwide problem. So when you bring everybody in the world into this equation, doesn't that lower the cost? It's like Walmart.
No.
Certainly there are efficiencies of scale, yes. So maybe it takes 30 years instead of 23. The point is, and Dr. Strumpke's point is absolutely correct, is that the current path of innovation that we're on is going to take more and more of our gross domestic product. This is why the budget of the National Institutes of Health was doubled a few years ago, and recently, even with the problems of austerity that we have now, there's been talk of doubling the budget of the National Science Foundation, because it's recognized that research needs more and more resources, but as research gets more and more resources, there's less available for consumption, there's less available for infrastructure, there's less available for the military, there's less available for all of the things that either we invest in or that we consume.
30 years ago, we didn't hear about these problems. At least the average person didn't. Maybe people in academic institutions and scientists who saw this, they saw it looming large, but we certainly didn't. So did it have this kind of urgency in the scientific community years ago, or is this something relatively new? This realization that we're about to go off the cliff.
I don't think the realization is widespread even today in the scientific community.
Could you be wrong?
Oh, I'd be happy to be wrong. but there were a few far-sighted individuals back as far as about 1960 who saw that the trend. There was a book written, published I think in 62 or so, called Little Science, Big Science, in which he predicted that science could grow for maybe another century, and then it would have essentially reached saturation point where it couldn't grow any farther. Now that was 50 years ago that he made that prediction, so we're already halfway there. So I think we're looking at 1 to 2 more generations of growth in science, growth in research.
Wow. We're going to come back to this enlightening and depressing conversation in just a moment. We have to take a break. I hope the electricity is still on when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bonnie Plants, offering gardeners more than 250 varieties of vegetable and herb plants since 1918. More details on gardening tips, planting plans, recipes, and nearby retailers at BonniePlants.com. Our roots run deep. And Hot Works, 5th Charlotte Fine Art Show, Friday through Sunday, uptown at the Convention Center, featuring original juried fine arts and crafts for sale, personally handmade by the artists. Show details at hotworks.org. New research suggests the college for all approach needs revision. Understanding who benefits from college and why, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Listen.
The radio illusionist.
plays or ought to play by different rules. Ears held through our hypnotic conjuring of associations, memories, inspirations, and ideas.
Listen to me.
Listen.
And then you just turn and you find yourself noticing.
Public radio that plays by different rules. Public Radio Remix from PRX. Saturday, 9 to midnight on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Clearly, we have Thomas Edison to blame for this morning's conversation. Had he not invented the light bulb, we would not be having this conversation. Dr. Deborah Strumsky, Associate Professor of Geography and Earth Sciences, with us from UNC Charlotte. They were given $1 million grant from the Department of Energy to study solar energy and how we could best invest in that to come up with, I guess, more success in that technology becoming more efficient and cost-effective. Dr. Joseph Tainter is also with us, Professor of Environment and Society, Dr. Doom at Utah, and called that for a good reason, Utah State University, is with us by phone. We talked about kind of reaching the end of science's ability to innovate ourselves out of the problems that we face. But I remember being in school years ago, in grade school, and people saying, well, the oil's going to run out by 19-whatever it was. And it was probably 1990 or 1980. And we found out that the oil did not, in fact, run out. And, in fact, we've developed new technologies to get to increasingly impossible pockets of oil. Will not something come along technologically that we haven't dreamed of, haven't thought of, haven't imagined that will get us out of this?
That is the hope. That's what a lot of people are counting on. And this, when we were speaking about this idea of these originations, that's the one thing that we can't forecast. And when they do come along, they are transformative. But that's a lot to pin your hopes on, that something like that will come along. You can't plan a society around it. You can't build an economy around it. And that's part of the concern. If you're hoping that an origination will come around, something that transformative, mm-hmm. and it's going to take a while to get it commercialized and scaled up, you're talking way beyond.
And are the arguments that we're having in the world today, politically and otherwise, about whether President Obama, for instance, got a lot of flack for investing in a company called Solyndra, a solar company that went out of business. Now, anybody who invests in the stock market knows that not everything that you put money into is going to be a winner. You're going to lose some money in the market no matter what you do, unless you're Warren Buffett, and I think even he has lost some money. So are the arguments that we're having saying, don't waste your money on these new technologies, put it into things we know about, put it into oil, put it into coal, is that slowing down the innovation that we must have in order to get ourselves out of this?
Actually, this is a point that I get really, really riled up about, because there's a big problem right now with how we invest our research dollars. Venture capitalists understand very well they're going to make 10 investments. Mm-hmm. They know darn right well 9 of them are not going to pan out. The task of the venture capitalist is to identify those 9 as fast as possible and shut them down, close them before they drain money that could be used in another investment that would have higher return. Mm-hmm. The problem becomes when you do this with government money, and particularly in the current climate that we have in Washington right now, is learning cannot take place without failure. If you're not making mistakes, you're not learning anything. It requires failure. You're going to make these investments in these new technologies, understanding that some of them must fail in order to find out what's going to work. And under the current climate, the way every failure is seen is as a waste of money, or worse, it's seen as intrinsically corrupt. This is holding down innovation rates, because you do support only those technologies that we're going to make these incremental improvements. And you can see this in the record, where we see an increasing shift away from originations, recombinations, and we're seeing this acceleration in investments in refinement technology.
Mm-hmm. Which would be fracking.
Right. We're getting really, really good at fracking right now, and we're getting better and better at more complex oil platforms. But
and then
that's
you have people getting upset, and politicians fueling this fervor about the phasing out of incandescent light bulbs. Now, they're not actually being phased out. You just can't use the one that Thomas Edison invented 150 years ago, whenever it was. They're different. They're more efficient incandescent bulbs, and now we have LEDs. Is it not incumbent upon us as individuals to go out and buy these things, even though they cost $30 a bulb, they last forever and they don't consume any energy? If we want to have lights, isn't it better to go out and buy an LED light bulb for $30 and let it sit in the lamp for 30 years and consume 2 cents of electricity every day?
Let me jump in on that, and I'll tell you an interesting story done in Sweden a few years ago. It's an example of the Jevons paradox, the notion that improving efficiency or conserving doesn't actually lead to less resource use. The study asked the question, if Swedes lived a so-called greener lifestyle, used less energy, ate less meat, used public transportation, what would they do with the money they save? And it turns out that what they do with the money they save is they'd like to travel more. Now, travel, of course, has its own environmental costs, so by reducing environmental damage in one area, eating less meat, using public transportation, they're increasing environmental damage in another area. In other words, if people save money by using fluorescent light bulbs, for example, they're simply going to use the money somewhere else that may cause an equivalent amount of environmental damage or use an equivalent amount of energy. So technological improvements, efficiency improvements, and conservation may actually be self-defeating in the long run. They may lead to more resource use than ever before.
So that means when I walk into the store and I look at the package of LED lights, and even though it costs $30 to buy this light, it says the average lifespan of this bulb is going to be 22 to 25 years. And the cost of running it in comparison to an incandescent bulb is like a penny a day. So I put this thing in my lamp and I'm thinking, well, I don't need to turn that off. It doesn't cost anything to run that. So over time, though, it does if you just leave it on. And people do that because it's not costing them anything in their minds, right?
Well, moreover, yeah, and over the lifetime with the cost savings, since you're not buying more replacement bulbs over those 22 years, you're probably taking that money and buying a slightly larger, more powerful car. So there you go. That's the trade-off that we make.
You also say, Dr. Tainter, that each dollar invested buys less of an energy reduction than the previous dollar did. Explain that.
Well, this is the problem of diminishing returns to innovation. In the study that Dr. Strumsky and Dr. Lobo and I did that I referred to a few years ago on the productivity of innovation, we looked at patenting overall, but then we also looked at patenting of innovations in various energy sectors, including renewable energy, and what we found was the same pattern overall, that the productivity is declining, that we're investing more and more to get back fewer and fewer innovations, fewer and fewer patentable innovations. And typically, as a technology evolves, as a technology becomes more efficient, the biggest savings come early on. And this is very clear if you study the history of something like the steam engine, where the biggest savings in fuel came very early on, and then later in time, the increments to efficiency become smaller and smaller until finally you reach the point where it's just not worth investing in efficiency anymore or in improving efficiency, that you've reached and gone well beyond the point of diminishing returns.
Have we reached that with automobiles?
I would say yes. Yeah, we have definitely reached that with automobiles. In the 1970s, when we had the two oil crises, people began to shift to buying smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. But instead of pocketing the money, what they did was they took the savings from driving more fuel-efficient vehicles and simply drove more miles. And this is very clear in the data put out by the Energy Information Administration. As people saved money by buying more fuel-efficient cars, they simply drove more miles. And this is a trend that's continued until fairly recently.
I don't know that either of you can answer this question, but is this something that can be fixed by behavior modification?
There would have to be substantial changes in how we live our lives. And even then, when you look at it globally, with population increases, it's not clear that you can have economic growth, population growth, under a system of finite resources, and not come up against some physical boundaries at some point.
You also say, one of you says, I'm not sure which one of you said this, that innovation buys us time, but it is not the solution. Why not, and how can you be so sure?
Well, again, this comes back to the issue of can we engineer ourselves out of certain problems? Yes, we can solve a lot of problems through engineering systems. The problem is at what cost? And as more and more people demand more and more goods and we use more and more resources at an accelerating rate, the cost of the innovations necessary to meet that demand get more and more expensive. So either you have economic slowdown or economic stagnation, mm-hmm. where you can't keep up the economic growth rate, or you reach a system that's just politically not stable.
Do the politicians, and I don't mean just the politicians in this country, but the politicians who run the Western world, and those in China and India, do they know this?
I'm not sure. I know in Europe they're very cognizant of trying to meet certain climate change goals, but they're also doing it in the face of other economies that want to grow the way Europe did and the way the U.S. is now, and you're certainly not going to hold those economies down or those societies down.
Right.
It's not so sure it's fair to do so.
Let me take a phone call here from Lawrence in Charlotte. Welcome. You're on the air, Lawrence.
Hey, Mike. Thanks. I've got a few comments and a question. I don't know if you remember that the lights on 277 weren't replaced with solar-powered lights because it would only save $1 million a year. It was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they need a different operational definition of the problem, that maybe that's part of the problem itself. But my question is, fusion, I know this comes up every once in a while, but why is there no Manhattan Project for fusion? They have super colliders. They're talking about the brain thing, and they did the Human Genome Project. But, fusion is probably the big answer, and there's not been anybody moving in that direction with any serious money.
Actually, fusion kind of comes and goes in waves of about 20 or 30 years or so. And the United States focuses on certain technologies that it favors. The EU sees things very differently. So whether you're looking at fusion or maglev turbines in Asia, you will see a similar thing. You don't see a lot of investment in the United States. However, fusion has seen a resurgence in Europe. They are doing some new research there. The problem is the timeline for fusion is so far out that no one's willing to make Manhattan-level investments yet because the timeline is so far beyond what current investments could yield in the short term.
I think the global warming issue might be the thing that would expedite the timeline right there.
Yeah, a lot of people are just feel at this point in time that they're better off with small-scale nuclear and other alternatives.
Why isn't the growing need for energy pushing technological developments? Why we know that we need more energy. We know India's coming online. We know China's coming online. Why isn't that pushing innovation and discovery and research and investment in all of that?
It is. I mean, part of the challenge I face, I teach an energy markets class, and the scope of new technologies that come out is so enormous. It's hard to even introduce the topics in one semester. The number of new innovations are just tremendous. The problem is not the engineering side. The problem is not that we're not inventing. We are inventing. And if you look at R&D budgets, they're increasing exponentially when you combine U.S. budgets and private firm budgets. The problem is the increase in energy efficiency or the decrease in costs, each subsequent invention buys you less. And that is underpins the problem there.
Lawrence, thank you for your call. Amy writes in an email, we were in Edinburgh about a year ago and stayed in a small apartment in a neighborhood of townhomes. Just around the corner was a large supermarket, lots of restaurants, shops and pubs, even pharmacies, plus bus stops that serviced an inexpensive transportation system. A person could obtain most of life's basic necessities without having to drive anywhere, plus have a thriving social life without owning a car. We took trains to other parts of the country, which were also inexpensive and efficient. Couldn't we solve a big big part of the energy problem if we in this country could rethink our lifestyles and dependency on cars and gas. At the time, a gallon of gas in Scotland was the equivalent of about $12, but the alternatives to automobile dependency were very attractive. So the question is, can we build, I don't think we have the political will, but if we did, could we afford to build our way out of this through better mass transit, more links-like rail lines and things like that? Could we do it? Would it make an impact?
Certainly, I think we could. It would require major re-engineering of our cities to rebuild our cities into what would be actual neighborhoods.
But wouldn't that create jobs and save the economy at the same time?
Certainly, it would. But we're not going to make the investment unless we're forced to do it because people like the lifestyle we have now. People like the automobile lifestyle.
And it would require part of what whenever I go to Europe, I absolutely love being able to take trains everywhere. But it also means you've got very dense town centers and then you have sharp borders to fairly low density areas. And that makes the transportation system feasible. That would be very difficult to replicate in something like Charlotte without completely dismantling how we've the urban sprawl.
Very quickly, John emails, can you discuss the idea of peak oil? And if it's real, if it is real, won't that force us to use alternative energies that would solve the global warming crisis? We've had the peak, haven't we, already? And that's why we're fracking now.
Yeah, Joe, you might want to speak to more on peak oil, but we have already
quickly,
peaked.
We reached peak production for conventional oil, which is shallow onshore oil, in 2005. And production of that has not increased since then. That's why we're going to more and more exotic technologies like fracking and drilling in very deep parts of the Gulf.
So I have 20 seconds left. Is this the beginning of the end? I mean, are you at all optimistic? Is there a bottom line here?
We're innovating faster, buying ourselves some time.
You're doing what?
We're buying ourselves some time. So, yes, we're innovating faster. In the short term, it won't affect us. We can remain in denial.
Dr. Taner?
Yes, I would agree with what Dr. Strumsky says, that sustainability consists of continually buying time.
Dr. Joseph Taner is a professor of environment and society at Utah State University. He joined us by phone from Logan, Utah, where it's earlier than it is here, so thank you for getting up so early. And Dr. Deborah Strumsky is associate professor of geography and earth sciences at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for the hour, I think.